Hello, welcome again to the Doomer Optimism podcast with my trusty sidekick, Ashley Colby. And today we have Neil Garenflo and Daniel London. Welcome, everybody. How's everyone doing today?
Good.
Been all right.
Cool. So the idea for this conversation came together on Twitter, as they often do, sadly, perhaps, but that's how it happens. And it came together through a couple of different interactions. One, a few months ago, when we were talking about the idea of bioregional economies and this idea of solidarity economies. And we want to kind of get into what both those are and the context for those and where each of them are lacking in these kind of ideas of, social forms and how they can form each other. We also got a little bit into kind of the historical context of, you know, I guess you could say the history of labor movements in general and the different forms those have taken, some more Marxist inspired and some not Marxist inspired. And so we could wrap some of that into the conversation as well. So without further ado, why don't Daniel and then Neil introduce yourselves? And then Neil, I'll let you kind of frame this conversation a little bit more after that.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Daniel London. I'm a policy specialist for the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy, and I'm also a historian. I got my PhD at NYU, where a lot of my research was on the history of what you might call solidarity economics, but focusing specifically on New York City. And since then, I've been researching and writing about American Populist Party, the anarchist CNT, and looking at how they tried to weave in different approaches towards economic development into their practice. So very interested in this discussion and looking forward to bringing in any context that's relevant.
Cool, yeah, welcome.
Thanks, Daniel. And highly recommend you follow Daniel on Twitter or Facebook or wherever, because he just shares the most interesting historical tidbits. I'm Neil Garenflo. I am the co-founder, ex-executive director, and now board president of Shareable. Shareable is a nonprofit with a mission to empower communities to share resources. We were founded in 2009, and we've been publishing stories about the frontiers of sharing, or the frontiers of the solidarity economy, and also the underappreciated aspects of those two things for that whole time. And so I've literally written or edited or been publisher of thousands of stories. I think we have something like 4,500 or coming on 5,000 stories on that topic. Very interested in it. And then I have other affiliations, like relevant affiliations like SCORI, where I share an affiliation with Ashley, which is a network of sustainable consumption and production scholars, activists, practitioners. And I've been involved with the New Economy Coalition through Shareable, also a former board member of the US Solidarity Economy Network. That's enough for now. To frame the conversation, or help frame it, basically where it comes from for me was I was really interested in the intersection of two movements, of the solidarity economy and of bioregionalism, or the bioregional movement, or the regeneration movement, kind of that mix of things, which is very, very land-based. I'm focused on landscapes and regenerating landscapes. I thought about how they could fit together, where one lacks, the other has. So in the solidarity economy, while there is more concern about environment than typical corporations or the mainstream economy, they still engage in a market economy. Aren't involved directly, the bulk of it, in regenerating landscapes. And then on the other side with bioregionalism, there seems to be maybe a lack of economic thinking or business models, and maybe this is a place where the solidarity economy could step in, and that the two could be a powerful force. So, you know, part of this is like exploring that intersection and those two pieces that I just described, and that intersection, and also a kind of call out to whoever is listening and follows the podcast is like, what do you know about this intersection? Like, please do share after this is, you know, published and out there. Love to hear comments and examples, actually case studies where these two things overlap.
Oh, cool. So I want to just jump in at first and say there's a couple of things that just come up for me, like right away with what you just described, Neil, which is there's an urban-rural thing going on here, obviously, and a lot actually stems from this geographic difference. Like there's just material differences that influence how culture is formed. So that's where my mind is going right now. And I'm thinking like, I feel like the solidarity economy people are more urban and they have a bent more toward the collective, like in to survive in urban environments. You have to work with other people. So you have to think about different ways of working with other people. But what they lack is just sort of like an ongoing stewardship of land and nature. In the rural context, we've got people who I see like basically doing individual farm businesses. You know, it's very individualistic. It's like, I'm going to get onto some land and I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to make a go of it, whether or not it's profitable, and it's usually not profitable. You know, not really thinking how can I start this as a collective effort. But what they have in their favor is like an ongoing relationship with land and nature and stewardship. That's something that really can't be recreated fully in the urban place context. It can be a little bit, but just, you know, I just got back from Uruguay to Chicago and just having this 9 acres to take care of, and like, it's in your face. Like you have to take care of this. Like you can see what it's not doing well. And you have this responsibility and you have to think through a lot of hard problems about being a steward. And you're kind of, it's like a trial by fire kind of thing. Whereas in an urban environment, it's kind of a trial by fire. Like you can't really be totally individualistic. If you're trying to get anything done, you've got to work with other people. Everyone's around you, you know, people are the frontier to navigate. So, and I don't know if Daniel, you have like some historical thoughts about this. This is a huge topic, but like the urban rural divide and how this determines the like political thinking, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could see examples of sort of agrarian collectives that are akin to the solidarity economy that you'd see in the American populist movement in the 19th century. And in Spain, certainly, you saw a very powerful communalization movement in the 1930s. And there's a lot of interesting work seeing how agricultural laborers in you know, in Aragon and Catalonia were trying to share land and trying to monitor the health of the soil. And there was a very deep regional component to that. But in terms of generalizing that, it's sort of tricky. I think that in the American populist movement, there wasn't a lot of discussion of land communalization the way there was in Spain. You're going to see it take different forms in different places. I think also putting on more of my policy hat, that this inattention to the regional dimension is also coming out of how a lot of the solidarity economy and a lot of economic actors more generally, they're not really looking at their environmental impacts in a local way. A lot of them are looking at CO2 emissions, which is a global issue. No matter where you are, if you pollute CO2, it's going to affect the planet's carrying capacity. But a lot of the other impacts that a company might generate or consumption generates are local, and not a lot of, I don't think, solidarity economy firms are monitoring that through their supply chain. Certainly not a lot of other sort of activities. And this is a missed opportunity, because if we are going to degrow, there's not going to be as high a profit margin for many firms. And for firms that are potentially going down to a limited dividend model or trying to recycle their profits back into the enterprise, I think they'll be better suited to a degrowth economy, but I don't think, like you're saying, there's a lot of communication between them and environmentalists on looking at the regional environmental impact of their activities. And that applies both in cities and potentially in the country. And this is just how they're, deriving from the way they're monitoring their impact. They're only looking at their global impact, not their local impact.
Totally, totally. Wait, Jason, I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast before, but Daniel just said the word degrowth that causes so many opinions to be generated. Do we want to have a brief detour on all of our opinions about degrowth, or is that going to take us too far off track?
Maybe we come back to it.
A little off track. I don't know if it's the bang is worth the buck or the buck is worth the bang. I think we can get back to that.
Okay.
Yeah, let's get back to that conversation a little bit later.
Okay.
I want to ground this conversation a little bit. Just in, can we define kind of the solidarity economy, and then we'll do the bioregional movement as well. Mm-hmm. What are the antecedents, right? What inspiration, you know, does it draw from? What are kind of the ideological currents that, you know, that have come together to create, you know, this framework, and how are we seeing this framework play out? Just for myself and for the audience, get a better sense of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and I did a little prep beforehand, just like, what are the best sources of a definition? And I picked out two that come at it from two different angles. I'll start with the United Nations, which is like, you know, of course, the most vanilla, but it has the benefit of being approachable. So this social and solidarity economy refers to forms of economic activities and relations that prioritize social and often environmental objectives over profit motives. I like how there they go, and often environmental objectives. That kind of speaks to what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So it goes on, but that's like a good start. And then the other one is from Nonprofit Quarterly, and it's from two people that I know from the Solidarity Economy Network, the U.S. network, and this has more of a kind of like emphasis on the activist left sort of origins and values, right? So solidarity economy is a post-capitalist framework that emerged in Latin America and Europe in the 1990s. It rejects state-dominated authoritarian forms of socialism, instead of affirming a core commitment to participatory democracy. Furthermore, it is explicitly feminist, anti-racist, and ecological, and advocates for economic transformation that transcends all forms of oppression, not just class. And that comes from an article on NP Quarterly called Systems Change, a Basic Primer to the Solidarity Economy by Emily Kawano and Julie Matai.
Okay. So maybe, Daniel, this is a question for you. So, and it's just on, it's on my mind because I've been reading kind of some Lash about this, and he has, of course, his own set of perspectives. But, you know, I'm reading about kind of this 19th century, and I think this is relevant here. You know, you have into the 20th century, it seems like you had a few different movements that were interested in some form of the solidarity economy. Let's just say labor movements back then, generally. You had kind of an agrarian populist movement, which generally rejected wage labor, the proletarization of people in order to move towards the revolution, the Marxist revolution. You know, they were advocates of cooperatives, for example, for larger scale enterprise, but not so much trade unionization, because that already implied wage labor. Of course, you had the Marxists, and, you know, their theory was that you needed industrial capitalism, you know, to mature and take its full form before you could have the glorious revolution. And this often meant, for example, was very kind of an anti-agrarian sentiment, in my view. It was very industrial oriented, not very environmentally oriented. You also have kind of the syndicalists, right, kind of in response, which very much emphasized kind of at least more subsidiarity in terms of kind of labor decision making. And then you have the anarchists, which are kind of in that mix as well. I don't have all of that kind of sorted out in my mind. And I really want Daniel to kind of help trace this lineage, you know, up until the solidarity economy. I heard, Neil, you said kind of, you know, it's against state authoritarian, right? So that kind of, you know, takes out some possible scenarios that could be in people's minds when they hear this. But what are these influences? Like, what are these earlier influences that it's drawing upon?
Yeah, wow. Okay, you bring me back to my grad school committee, facing my committee question days. All right. I mean, I think all of those elements are here. I think that the, this sort of primal divide between the Marxist tradition and the anarchist, syndicalist, populist, that really goes to the 1870s and 1880s. Before then, it was a very mixed bag. You had, you know, various they weren't as clearly defined then as they were now. I think that the stress on the stress really comes down to the question of the state, I think, just to prioritize that for now. I think that the assumption from the Marxists was that the growth of corporations would entail the growth of the state until they became basically unanimous. And at that point, with immiseration, there would simply be a need to take over the state and you'd be taking over the economy. And I think to a certain extent, the liberal state or the social democratic state followed up on this, but simply saw the state as countervailing power to the large corporations. And lost in all of this was the idea that there was a third sector or civil society had any kind of economic role, or that the economy could be decentralized into the hands of people who are not strictly market actors or strictly public sector actors. And I think that the idea of cooperatives were seen as either as a relic or utopian, but basically anything other than the corporate private form was seen by many Marxists and by many liberals as the only form of economic agent or the state to take it over. I think what happens in Latin America by the 1980s and 90s is that it's very clear that the neoliberal reforms are not working and that the capacity of the government to deliver compensatory aid is also not quite as working. And what you're finding instead are people are able to work to help one another through these very difficult times and develop a sort of interstitial economy that draws on existing communal resources and communal attachments, but that is also grounded in a very decolonial lens and grounded also in some elements of socialist thought or anarchist thought that aren't as dogmatized or in a binary form that you might find elsewhere at the time. And there are some differences between the way that it emerges in Latin America and the way that it might emerge in the global north. I think in global north, you have this idea of the third sector where the social economy is sort of just a compensating sector for whatever the state or the market can't do. And I think it's taken a little longer for people in the north to think of this sort of alternative economics as a way of actually challenging and replacing the dominant sort of economic paradigm. But hopefully we'll try to see some convergence there. I think the story in the North is sort of its own thing, but the real vanguard of this is in the global South. And I think you can't really disattach that from the neoliberalism of the 80s, 90s. I think what happens in the global North is just that these binaries left over from the late 19th century between state and market, they last for a long time, but there are these submerged traditions that we're now sort of going back to and we're trying to learn from them. So I hope that was some kind of clarity there. Sorry, there's a lot of moving pieces. pieces to the story.
No, it's like basically the history of how people have responded to industrialism. So we're it's you know we're at, we're this is like yeah this is a big question for the podcast. Jason, I'm wondering whether or not you want to do at least a brief definition of bioregionalism, you know, regeneration movement, this kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, maybe Neil could give a better definition. I'll give my own, and then Neil, maybe you can expand upon it. Does that make sense?
I could, but that's not my battle. I'm more of a beginner there. So
okay.
Yeah, I can expand. I can try expanding on it if you want.
Well, I think of it in two different ways. One is purely just in terms of political boundaries, and it's the idea that political boundaries should align with eco-cultural boundaries, right? And so many of the boundaries that we see, especially in formerly colonized countries, are very artificial and quite violent in terms of how they split apart different ethnicities and put together other ethnicities. And so it didn't make any kind of cultural sense except from the point of view of the colonizer. And so we still have the legacy of that. And then we also have the ecological boundaries. You know, there was this, we had a previous podcast with Andrew Millison, and he was talking about how Powell, I forget his full name, but he was advocating in like the 1800s watershed democracy for the United States, where, you know, states and even counties would be delineated based on watersheds and sub-watersheds, and just how much more sense that would make in terms of land management and kind of navigating the various jurisdictions around land management. And also he was talking about how, you know, he's been doing a lot of documentary work in India of like whole Indian villages adopting these kind of permacultural principles and seeing these like drastic results. And we were commenting that that's only possible because the whole village can get on board, and that whole village happens to align with the watershed boundaries, right? And that's just kind of the historical legacy that connection never got cut. And it makes ecological and social regeneration much more viable. And so, you know, the second aspect of bioregionalism is just, you know, designing society and cultures around landscapes, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a political boundaries issue, but then there's just the more of the ethos that a lot of, you know, bioregionalists in the 60s and 70s, you know, talked about of, you know, how do we align human cultures around landscapes? And that's how most human cultures, you know, have existed, you know, for, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. Most indigenous cultures, you know, aligned around landscapes. You know, they had to. They didn't have the fossil fuel and technology to cover, you know, to destroy, you know, to remove a mountaintop if you want the coal, for example. So it's asking the question, you know, given where we are today, how do we move back in that direction, you know, with the baggage and or opportunity of modernity, you know, with us and behind us, you know, and
yeah.
Modern technology and the, you know, the fact that you can't always go backwards, you have to move forward. So how do we start connecting ecological corridors again for various endangered species? How do you restore watersheds and, you know, align human settlements with watershed management? How do we start living more ecologically? What it really comes down to. And so it's kind of a form of localism as well, of being connected to your landscape, but it's you know, it's a little bit broader idea than the concept of the village.
And I would just add briefly that the other thing that's a theme in the regeneration movement is looking to past civilizations who had ecological practices, like humans as steward roles, that could be recreated in the modern era with modern tools. So like, for example, a big tool for regeneration is this thing called rotational grazing, which is kind of mimicking how Native Americans managed bison in the Great Plains. So like looking to this ecological heritage and kind of trying to bring those principles forth. And now the way farmers do it is just through electric fencing, and they kind of bunch their cattle together and they do the similar kind of process that Native Americans did with planned burns and some management of the bison populations that built like this crazy rich topsoil and in the whole center of the United States. And So I think that's in some important context.
Yeah, and I would just add one little tidbit is just, you know, looking at it like bioregionalism from an economic perspective, you know, instead of, you know, building the economy kind of to address a kind of abstract market using, you know, price signals, you instead, you know, build the economy from bottom up, from the landscape up, and use signals about the health of the health of the ecosystem as guidance.
And I would just say, like, I guess one thing that's like the elephant in the room here is that all of these things we're talking about are alternatives to the mainstream industrial, both market and state, in sort of propping up the market. And all the kinds of strategies we're talking about are just sort of trying to be crafty ways to like combat that. It's hugely powerful. The state is hugely subsidizing industrial, you know, processes, manufacturing, agriculture. So it is like, it does, all of this that we're talking about does feel like an uphill battle because you're really just trying to be crafty against this giant behemoth that has huge amounts of momentum and energy and power. Both literally energy and like human capital power, political power. So anyway, just a little elephant in the room is that this is in, you know, in contrast to that mainstream system, basically.
Yeah, Ashley, I so resonate with that because just my experience at Shareable, it was, you know, a learning journey, you know, and, you know, I came into it thinking like a parallel economy could be, you know, could be developed. And you know, that faded pretty quickly, and the realization that you have to engage in politics to make room for the alternative to survive, and to combat the dominant system as well as like remove those subsidies so there's kind of like a level playing field, you know. At the same time, you know, I differ from some of my you know, peers in that I saw the possibility of a kind of heterodox economy where you know, these different forms could coexist and be complementary, and also where the state, the market, and the commons could interact in a synergistic way, a complementary way. And you know, I wasn't of the opinion that we would move from one monolithic model to another. I don't think that's a good idea.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually something part of the reason I was interacting with Daniel is, this article I wrote for On Her that came out, called The Case for Left Conservatism. It's not a term I came up with. It's some term that's sort of been used throughout the years. Norman Mailer famously used it. And one of the takeaways of the article is really it's just an issue of scale. And by that, I mean, the solution should be human scaled. There's this idea of subsidiarity, which is keeping things at the scale, keeping solutions at the scale of the problem, that the lowest possible scale for solving the problem that's presented. And what that means in practice is that there is no one solution. It's going to be a context-based solution. So this is part of the background of these solidarity economies and bioregionalism is what works in a water basin in Appalachia is not going to work in a water basin in, you know, the desert in Arizona. It's going to be a totally different set of solutions at different scales and look differently. So people are saying, like, you know, what do you want? You want degrowth? You want this? You want? And I'm like, there is, but people are so used to these global solutions that they just want, like, what is your prescription? And I'm like, I'm not like the head of the WEF. I'm not trying to like tell you all to do something. The whole point is like, is specific, diverse, and like self-determined by civil society, by local cultures.
I would just add to that. I mean, not only is that just politically more effective, but it's also more resilient more generally to have a diversity of organizational forms. And there's a great book I've been reading by Rodrigo Nunes called Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal, A Theory of Political Organization, where he talks about the need to think of organizations as an ecosystem. And rather than trying to homogenize everything into one form, you're trying to think of how these different organizations, a party, a cooperative, a state, how can they complement one another in this kind of jujitsu fashion, right? So I think trying to think of things in a relational and complementary fashion is sort of helpful.
Right. Yes, you have more, but I just want to add a tidbit to you. Can think about like how a reef ecosystem works. And other ecosystems too, as well as like, there's various functions, ecological or biological functions in a reef. And what makes them healthy and resilient is that often there are multiple species that do the same function, right? And I think that's the kind of thing we want in our society and an economy, not just one that does everything. And I think the state, when you have a big state and a very powerful state, I think there's kind of an inability to like nurture that kind of ecosystem. Like it's just not legible to them. And how do you create a policy structure that, I'm sure it can be done. I think it might be difficult for a variety of reasons, a kind of policy and structure that supports a heterodox economy.
Yep.
I mean, maybe this is a good question, is what is, if any, is the role of the state in a kind of healthy eco-solidarity economy? What can the state do, one, to get out of the way, and two, to actually be supportive and not, put their thumb on the scale of one homogenized solution?
Curious. I mean, I know one example rurally, and maybe you guys have from your time at Shareable, Neil, some urban examples, but rurally, there's this thing called the EQIP program. It's an acronym. I forget what it stands for, but it's a federal government program, and a lot of small farmers can use it. It's basically like I have friends who use it. I have like people who do like really cool permacultural projects who get funding for this. It's like subsidies to put in fences or to plant trees, like to do agroforestry, to do all this really cool stuff. And it's of course a drop in the bucket relative to ag subsidies of commodity crops, but it's the same kind of mechanism, and they're not too like controlling or top down about how it's used. And it gets used for like really cool regenerative ag, locally specific diverse projects. So, I mean, it's definitely possible to subsidize these things in a way that allows for that kind of diverse use cases. I don't know the urban context as well, if there's like the role for the state in something like subsidizing these activities.
Yeah, a couple thoughts. So there's this concept that Michelle Bounds talks about. I don't think he's the originator, but the idea of the partner state. So that, the partner state creates an enabling environment for the commons, for the solidarity economy, et cetera, subsidiary is like an important concept, I think, there also. And then in the urban context, there's this awesome book you guys should check out. It's called Co-Cities by Christian Yayoni and Sheila Foster. Two lawyers who are also scholars who took Eleanor Ostrom's and other common scholars' ideas about how agrarian and rural commons are managed, like the governing principles, like Ostrom's 8 principles for governing a commons, and sort of like fit that into an urban context and reimagine the city as a commons.
Oh, cool.
It's really cool. I mean, I think it's one of the most groundbreaking books I've ever read, to be honest. So I would really check that out. They've really broken some really exciting ground with it. And it's really interesting too, what they had to do to rethink those common principles, because the urban environment is a different beast. It's, unlike rural commons, they aren't geographically isolated to a certain extent. You have a commons in a very tight, like, institutional web you're rubbing elbows with a bunch of different players, where like the commons purists would not want any involvement with market or state. In the urban commons context, there has to be some linkage and cooperation and accommodation, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's like a really useful like look at how to organize an economy in a different way in the urban environment, at least.
I mean, I will say, just based on the example of Spain that I wrote about recently for Shareable, I mean, the sort of way that the state or state-like thinking can come in can be sort of on the back end here. And in the example of the Aragon case, after the wave of communalizations in 1937, there were some communes that were richer, there were some that were poorer. And there was the question of whether there should be any distribution between them. And to determine the distribution, the different communes developed statistics that were based on their amount of income, their amount of excess produce. Those were aggregated on the local, the regional, eventually set up to the federal level, or at least the, you know, the sort of aggregate level. And then those statistics were used to create distribution between the communes. And the difficult thing was that some of these communes did not want to reveal how much excess they had, because they didn't want to allow that to be distributed. And so then there was the question, well, how do we check to see if these statistics are accurate? And, you know, there's so much you could do on trust, but it made some pretty knotty kind of questions come up. And those are the sort of things that, you know, we should be able to anticipate. But it does, I guess, in the bioregional context, it comes up for me in the sense that coming up with ecological or environmental statistics is going to be very important. I mean, the way that one commune's pollution could be affecting another commune. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be some capacity for these statistics to be shared on who's being impacted by what. And, you know, John Dewey talked about the state as being formed up by different publics who were affected by a shared consequence. And as long as people could identify what those shared consequences and formed a sort of group around it, for him, that counted as a state, so to speak. Now, that isn't the only way of defining it, but, you know, the way that the anarchists in Catalonia came up with solutions to these questions of statistics, it does start, and how to enforce them, it does sort of blur some of these categories on what counts as the state and what doesn't. So that's just one thing to anticipate, that there's not going to be any neat dividing line here.
I know that this is so unhelpful, but I just hate, like, as soon as you start saying statistics are going to determine redistribution, like, my brain just explodes, because I just have seen so many bad actors with statistics, especially in the modern era, where they can be totally manipulated for whatever political ends. And my instinct, and this is not very helpful in a post-industrial, globalized, modern world, it's not helpful at all, but my instinct is to just, is there any way to do this in a more humane knowledge-gathering way than statistics? Because as soon as you start aggregating information to those levels, there's so much political pressure to use information in extremely, I don't know, dangerous ways, super dangerous ways. And so this is like why the subsidiarity thing really appeals to me, because it's like, you know, the lowest possible scale we can pull off for any of these questions is important. And the most robust civil society, trust-based, I actually know because I'm checking with my own eyes, reputational, like, you know, this kind of cultural solutions is what I lean toward, because it's just so, like, but we're in this modern era where things are super hyper-scaled, and you have these corporations doing crazy stuff, and you need to be able to, like, monitor that they're pouring a bunch of chemicals into a watershed or whatever. But I'm just like, I don't know. I just have to say that my alarm bells always go off with that kind of thing.
Yeah, I get it. Spreadsheet brain. I hear you say.
Yes, yes.
One of your favorites. You know, and it just, when you're talking about it though, in a more humane way, you know, to gather statistics, but it made me think of like the way that commons are managed, which you know, commons, the thing about commons, there's three pieces to a commons. It's the users, it's the resource, and it's the governance piece, right? And a commons is closed membership, like there, so it has you know, a distinct boundaries in terms of the people and the resource, right? And so then you know, becomes a more communal way of managing that resource, where you know, people have discussions about the state of their commons. You know, can we put more cattle on this thing, or do we need to have less cattle? And then they just, you know, then there's a decision about like how many per user can graze on that shared grazing land, for instance. And you know, if conditions are poor, then people agree, like, we, you know, people in a commons context are, you know, thinking very long term. You know, they want to, this resource to be there for as long as possible. This is their livelihood. They want their children and their families to be often can be, you know, beneficiaries of this common and participants in a commons, you know, so long term. And so if the commons that they're managing is in a poor state, then they behave, you know, appropriately. And that's the beauty of the Elerna Ostrom's work is kind of providing a lot of evidence that commons based management is more sustainable than state or market. So then if you take that and think about blowing that up as like a larger global way to like manage resources, then you start to, you know, see something very different. Mm-hmm. And you don't have this need to like have these aggregate statistics that need is less, right?
Yep.
Could we define the state simply as larger scale coordination among smaller entities where there is some kind of externality associated with it, right? Or some kind of, you know, some kind of expectation of solidarity in terms of, if this region isn't doing well, this region has surplus, they'll, you know, they'll send extra resources over or extra, you know, knowledge, know-how over, something like that, you know, as well as kind of larger scale, you know, bioregional or cross bioregional air quality issues or water quality issues. Is that, I'm trying to just get a common notion of like a sense of like what, in an idea of a healthy state, what role is it playing? Is it some kind of governance of, you know, a multiple of localities? Is that what we're kind of defining as a state? And this is where the question of statistics comes in and everything else.
I mean, just getting it back to the CNT, I mean, they purely saw the higher tiers of government, or not government, sorry, Freudian slip, but of their organization as sort of an information aggregating sort of entity. And then once that information was there, it was up to these communes or their representatives to decide what to do with it. And that was sort of a minimal definition, at least. So that's maybe one way towards approaching what the role could be. We want to minimize the role of statistics as much as possible, as you're saying, Ashley.
Well, the reason I bring that up is it seems like the elephant in the room is the commons historically have worked great in very prescribed regional contexts with, you know, very specific resource, very specific, you know, geography, mm-hmm. culture. But when we start getting into larger scale, you know, multi-ethnic, pluralistic, you know, kinds of relationships.
It
seems like you either, I haven't seen where the principles of the commons have really come into their own yet, right? In terms of where, you know, what happens at these larger coordination scales, right? Do you need the market to come in to mediate between commons, for example, or the state, some kind of state entity to mediate between the commons, right? And that's what I'm just trying to it's not in my mind that I'm going to work out as we talk.
I feel your struggle and share it. I point to for some inspiration or context, point to the Mondragon Corporation, which is I believe it's the largest worker co-op in the world.
Yeah.
And what's different there in the hierarchy is that the higher levels of the hierarchy serve the lower levels. Power doesn't roll up. Rather, the higher levels in the hierarchy serve the lower levels, right? And in a sort of solidarity economy or commons-based economy, I would see that would be, the way power would flow, and that the state is plays a role in as a kind of rulemaker, a referee in the governance, the democratic governance of resources, of enterprises, of democratic enterprises. So you could also, I'll pivot here to the Italian cooperative economy, and which is a different, it's kind of a different beast. Mondragon is like one economic organism with many different parts. It has it's an umbrella with 80 or so different pieces to it, different enterprises within it. Whereas
I will note real quick that it's as impressive as it is, it's still confined to one specific ethnicity in one part of the country, the Basque region of Spain, with a very specific history that arose out of defiance of Franco, fascism. And so it still has that certain specific identity that draws.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not like people, there is a tendency in some quarters to like lionize this and so I'm not part of that. I'm aware of some of the drawbacks. They are very oriented to because they're so huge, and they've got huge because they sell into a global marketplace. And they even have had enterprises outside of Spain that were not democratically controlled, but owned by the corporation. So they're and also have been kind of in some people's opinion, sort of the MBA mentality has gotten more sway than maybe some would like. The Italian co-op model, these are two ecosystems where in the case of Italy, it's the whole country, but in the Emilia Romagna region, 30% of the GDP is cooperative. So this is a very high concentration. And the way they got there is a different route, which is not through like this big one, economic organism with many different parts. It is many different parts that are connected through associations and who create like shared infrastructure, right? That enable them to compete in the global marketplace, but they also have constitutional consideration in the Italian, the state constitution. There is a place for them, and it's protected, and the integrity of the co-ops are protected. For instance, there are some very strong tax incentives and other incentives that co-ops don't convert to traditional like firms. There you can see the state playing a really active role through the constitution, tax code and regulation, and enabling co-ops to really thrive.
Yeah, I would just add to that, like the way I conceptualize it is the state, like the large, nation state regulations are going to give the broadest possible protections for the, they're going to have some sort of regulations in place so that, that allow cooperatives to bloom, for example, but, you know, the broadest possible civil society protections against extreme behavior and that kind of thing. The oversized market is going to give the broadest possible provision of goods and services, but everything else can be civil society. And like cooperatives are a great example because they're both market and state, or yeah, they're both providing like market and state. They have their own internal governance, but they are also providing some sort of market services. So it's like a civil society third type of actor. And in the vision, I think when we're talking about solidarity economy and bioregionalism, we're talking about this robust third actor, whereas these two oversized market and state actors were that things power just keeps getting devolved more and more to them. And we're saying like push elbow some room for this third actor, which is, you know, like a civil society governance would be social norms. You know, we don't do that. It's how you teach your kids how to be good or bad. And, you know, the state isn't necessarily coming in and saying, you know, eat your dinner. Your parents are doing that. This is how civil society works. This is how you put social norms and that determine sort of behavior. And then, you know, market actors, people could be having backyard chickens. This is your own provisioning of some sort of good for yourself. And so more and more robust versions of that is, I guess, what we're talking about. I don't know if as anyone has anything to add on that, but I kind of want to shift to some critiques that Neil started with, which are, what are the solidarity economy people lacking, which is something I rail on and on about on Twitter. And what are the, you know, what are the regeneration people lacking? And I do think that they're probably lacking something that we could discuss and maybe have positive, you know, some like positive feedback on. And I, to me, it's like there's a lot of cultural stuff going on here. There's certain types of cultures who are partaking in these things, and they're not necessarily the most inclusive. They're neither the most inclusive types of cultures. They're a little bit hard to break into. They've got their own ethos that, you know, has all its own little quirks of culture. And so I could start with the solidarity economy. And to me, this kind of does tie in with the degrowth people, because one of my degrowth critiques, while everything philosophically makes sense to me, okay, we don't want to plan our lives around GDP. You know, there's other ways to measure success of a society. But there's so much academic jargon. There's so much that's hard to break into for a normal person to like, what is degrowth? I got to put a sweater on. It's like everything that everyone got mad at Jimmy Carter for. You know what I mean? It's just like, and yeah, then there's, right. And then there's like all this, like, there's like the right way to speak culturally in a city around these people that annoys me. Cause it's like, just be normal, like, you know, try to meet people where they're at with the language that they're, you know, used to. And then the other thing is like a big spreadsheet. They have a spreadsheet brain problem, at least with regard to environmental issues. They're very much focused on like climate above all other environmental issues. And that really annoys me because sometimes that can culturally be used as like a cudgel against anyone who's not like focused on climate as the most important and only environmental issue worth talking about. Including rural people who themselves are land stewards and do a really good job stewarding land, but may or may not think of climate change as like so political that they're annoyed by it, you know? And they're like, whatever about climate, but you know, I'm here like managing my woodlot sustainably. Do you care about that at all? So there's this like cultural divide that I just think is worth having a little rant about on this podcast. and then, you know, I think in the rural side, like, both like traditional rural people can be like anti-city. And I've seen myself, I shouldn't be, I'm from a city, but I've seen myself be annoyed by the city people. And then it's like this piling on of division, like, you know, these city people don't understand. They're trying to make us all live in the pod and eat the bugs. And that's hard, you know, to break into culturally as well. And there's a little bit of a chip on the rural shoulder of like, you know, this, you know, I like they're basically encroaching on my livelihood and my ability to be free. And like I said at the beginning, I think there's also a sort of individualistic, necessarily individualistic and sort of business oriented approach to regeneration. Like, I'm just going to make a business out of this. And I'm kind of on my own. And I know a lot of people, like, you know, Nate, for example, who's been on this podcast a bunch, like, he has a hard time making go of it as a farmer and trying to like break even. And it's hard and it's lonely. And I think that he would probably be amenable to some kind of like solidarity, cooperative arrangement with other people like him. But I think there just is a kind of cultural block with that. So that's my rant, my cultural sociology rant, if anyone wants to add anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, the just a couple things is just, you know, one of the things that was really, you know, really attractive to me about this social and solidarity economy and cooperatives and credit unions, all these institutions, they have such bipartisan potential.
Yes.
They have different appeals to different parties or different ideological orientations. Ideally should be communicated in that way. But it just isn't.
I know.
And I mean, I could sort of agree with that to a certain extent on the degrowth issue. I mean, I would define degrowth, to get to that, as the decrease in the production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate. Let's just make that the bare bones. And with that in mind, way that you can talk about degrowth is just sustainable development. You can talk about it as living within the Earth's limits or the environment's limits. And it aligns with many things people are already doing in terms of conservation, land stewardship. The idea is basically reducing unnecessary throughput and reducing the incentives to produce that throughput. And, you know, the way of communicating policy for me is, how can these policies solve the problems you have? It's not about imposing my definition of the problem. It's about working with the problems that you are facing right now and how this policy could help. And at this point, the degrowth folks are beginning to think in that lens, and I'm certainly trying to do that as well. But yeah, I would agree that it's somewhat abstract at this point. And I think that the alignment between the solidarity economy folks and bioregionalism, I'm just finding that, like you're saying, the CO2 issue is really so paramount, not just among them, but among the environmental movement as a whole. And it's really taken over discussion of other planetary boundaries that are being transgressed around biodiversity and water, et cetera. And that's where we need to think more locally. And we're not really having things up in mind. One example of this is, you know, in terms of conservation, most of the areas that need to be conserved right now for biodiversity are not in state or public hands, at least in the US. Most of them are in private farmlands. And that is an opportunity in some ways for us to rethink how we're approaching agriculture and farmers, but, you know, we're not necessarily doing that. So I think that's part of it. Just the way we're defining the environmental crisis is pretty limited right now, and our way of gauging the effects of what we're doing is very limited.
Yeah, and just going back to like the critique of the solidarity economy is like, yeah, we kind of touched on this. Just, you know, I gave the example of the Italian like co-op economy and how successful it is, and that they have found a way to, you know, small to medium-sized SME cooperatives have found a way to compete in the global economy through cooperation between cooperatives, right? And then what Mondragon Corporation does. And, you know, this is a huge, you know, they become big and successful as cooperatives because they have this market orientation. There isn't an ecological orientation or ecological economics sort of component that's informing these, you know, very successful like examples of the co-op economy.
So I'm going to try and bridge a couple of things here. One, where the bioregional solidarity economy can come together. And then second, on this idea of degrowth, I mean, for me, it seems like the problem with degrowth is the framing. I understand that it's hard to co-opt degrowth, unlike sustainability, and so it's kind of a missile term. And I see the value in that. But it seems to me that, if you had to focus more on agrarian revival, if you had to focus on localization or cosmo-localization, we can get into that too if we want, like degrowth is a natural byproduct of that, because if you're shortening supply chains, you're necessarily becoming less efficient in a narrow sense in your production. There's probably going to be less linear throughput, and people are closer to land. Degrowth is going to be a natural result, and it feels like it's a framing that at least is a lot more attractive to the rural sensibility, maybe not the urban sensibility. So this is then this connection, and I think where we're bringing this conversation is, if we were to bridge these two movements, what does that actually mean geographically, right? So I've used the term like, bioregionally embedded cities. I think new urbanism is kind of, we've interacted a lot with the new urbanists, and there's kind of a bridge there where if you think of, okay, how do we rethink cities, and both economically, bringing back in the commons and a lot of, in a lot of space in the cities, but also how the city is itself situated in the larger region and the flows of resources back and forth, right? Because that's really the real issue, is we're not going to bridge these things until we understand how they actually work together in a geographic and material flow sense, right? And so if we think of like the example of the cooperatives in Italy, and if we extend that to what is their interaction with the rural countryside, right, and land stewardship and watersheds, that to me is a very fruitful line of investigation that is not as controversial, to me at least, in my mind, as arguing over degrowth or something like that.
Yeah, that appeals to me. I think there is something to the urban rural, like just some more urban rural bridges are really important. I think what Neil said earlier, that there is something so universally appealing about so much of both of these movements, that once you get past some of the more alienating or jargony language and get down to the brass tacks of like actually experiencing a lot of these things, part of my dissertation research was just finding when people sort of work together, experiencing, sharing knowledge, sharing information about, basically backyard provisioning, a lot of that, the jargon and the words sort of fall away. Like, totally. There's a huge difference between the experience of going to a degrowth meeting and hearing people be like, blah, 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 like material throughput, blah, blah, blah. And then the actual experience of like going to somebody's house and seeing their chicken coop and being like, how did you build this? And how does it work in the winter? And like, one of them is like degrowth in action. And the other one is like the theory of degrowth that has all this like cultural baggage with it. And you're like, I don't even know what to do with this as a normal person. I was going to say a couple of other things too. One is I am involved with this project, that's specifically focused on localizing food supply chains in five different countries, and with a focus on cooperatives with this scholar, Arnim Week, in University of Freiburg. And he's like the cooperative guy. He does studies these things. And he was basically like showing us around Freiburg, and there's just so many small cooperative, farmer cooperatives, business, bakery cooperative, grocery store. Like, it's just a blossoming of many different cooperatives that sort of then are kind of forming things together and maybe building into food councils that are members of each cooperative are, go on to this food council, food policy council, and try to influence local policy to get more work towards these cooperatives. And I need to get him on because I need to know more about what's going on in Freiburg. So it seemed really cool when we went to visit him. A very good cosmo-localism like type example. And then the other thing I just wanted to bring up is something I've been kind of, something changed in me like in the past half a year or something, which I've been thinking about this out loud on Twitter for a long time. But basically the idea is like, I think the environmental movement in general, like because of the statistics spreadsheet orientation, they do realize like they see so much waste in material throughput that they're just like, this has got to stop. This is out of control. But then the orientation is like a sort of philosophical call for less that then turns into this like, you know, like I said before, like this granolier than thou, this cudgel, this like way to like tell people like you don't get to do these things. Like you don't, you there, we there are things we need to take away. And the flip I've made recently, especially talking to some people like Neil Spackman, who's done these huge regenerative projects that completely transformed ecosystems. Like he went to Saudi Arabia and just greened the desert with almost no rainfall. I just think we could really change the language around some of this stuff to like an orientation towards more, but more of the right thing. Like more green, like greening the desert, or more free time, or more meaning in your work, or more time with your family, or you know, like more civil society, you know, more participation in the
Yeah.
things that are closest to you that are most meaningful. And I just think that there's like a really important shift that's right. We're right on the cusp of articulating it. And I don't think anyone's done a really good job of politically articulating it. And I was trying to articulate in that Left Conservatism article, which is that like there's just so much that's sort of been hollowed out by these the overscaled market and state actors that we need to reclaim and see as like, oh, it's a worthy goal to reclaim these things. You know, it's like it's exciting. There's infinite upside, regenerative upside to this orientation.
Yeah, I can relate to that last sentiment, and it just makes me think of this like this way of like looking at actually looking at consumption. Like there, if you're if you're a consumer and you're engaged in the consumer economy, and there's products out there, some of them that are addictive. The more you buy, the less satisfaction you get, right? On the other hand, there is this other path that you can take, where you spend your time on things which the more you do them, the more satisfaction you get. You know, maybe it's music, maybe it's spiritual life, maybe it's your life as part of a cooperative or in civil society, that you become a more capable citizen and a more effective citizen, right? And the more you do it, the better kind of participant you become. And I think we're, I think we're like on the exact opposite of that path.
I mean, I would say that the when I think about the sort of need to shrink the aggregate size of the economy, that's the aggregate. Within that, you're growing sectors that we want to see grow, like regenerative farming, like solidarity economy or whatnot. And I think that the focus on degrowth is that aggregate level. And particularly the what the planet can handle. The number one thing is scale. That is the first thing that ecological economists think of. Within scale is our questions of efficiency and distribution. But I think that we sort of lose the trees for the forest in a sense by focusing so much on the limits, the overall limit that we're thinking about, and not the things within those limits that we want to grow that actually will help us a lot more. And on that point, I think that the solidarity economy would be of great benefit to the bioregional cause in sort of by shifting more of the economy towards that and away from the extractivist other kind of logics. And sorry for using logics. That was but I think that the way the I just see this need for the folks in the solidarity economy to be sourcing and in contact as economically as much possible from folks who are involved in the bioregional movement. I don't know if the solidarity, that for me just seems like an in, at least, just the fact that sourcing from these people. And, and they, by extension, are thinking of the bioregionalism of their sourcing, right?
Right.
So it's sort of by proxy, the solidarity economy will be involved in the bioregionalism, and that at least can be an in, you know, make it in their self-interest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see where there's a natural alliance. I mean, we talked about this a lot on the podcast, but, or I've talked about it at least, is that one of the biggest bottlenecks of bioregionalism is land ownership, consolidated land ownership and land access, right? And I certainly think something like a community land trust movement, or even just, you know, kind of an apprenticeship, revival of apprenticeship movement of, you know, older people who have land and younger people who want to get on land. You know, this requires sometimes old, reviving old, but also new and innovative cooperative arrangements to actually, you know, how do we break the extractivist economy? One, we have to probably localize or bioregionalize a lot of our production and have more integrated urban-rural relationships, right? But to even start that, you know, we have to think about, well, how do we actually get people directly on the ground doing this? And I think that's where a lot of innovative institutional or informal institutional kind of arrangements and ideas from a solidarity economy can really be helpful. And of course, I think there's already plenty of examples. Like, I'm thinking of, like, you know, the landless workers movement in Brazil, for example, right? This is a very clearly a solidarity economy kind of movement that's also very much agrarian and on the ground, right? And it's very much a response to extreme land consolidation in the country. I'm sure there's several others that you guys could cite, but you know, I think this is thinking about, I think what we've been kind of all inching towards here is, you know, in what ways can these two movements really be supportive and really help each come into its own?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were going in the direction I wanted to speak to too. So that's and thinking in terms of like a bridge into, or where there could be an overlap. I visited a co-housing community that is being developed on 240 acres of land where it's called Rooted Northwest, and so it's you know, it's under development now. It's you know, will be roughly 35 families to start, and the idea is that the people who live in the co-housing community will also be stewards of the land and have agricultural enterprises, right? Mm-hmm. And then they will also have like a roadside marketplace eventually, and other enterprises. And you know, when a co-housing development, that you could put that in the solidarity economy to an extent. It is, you know, the governance is democratic. It's they're going to use, and most co-housing developments use like condominium, like legal framework and governance framework. And you know, this makes sense to me for a few important reasons. One is that, you know, what is going to happen to agricultural land in the United States and other places? You know, the family farm is dying out, right? And big corporations are, and big investment funds, institutional investors are just buying up farmland like nobody's business right
yeah.
now, right? But this is an alternative model where you have not one family and not a corporation become stewards of the land, and that seems much more sustainable. And as farmers like age out, this transition is going to kind of accelerate, because while there are some people who want to go and become farmers, I wonder if we have the numbers to replace the farmers that we have right now.
Yep. Yep.
And then just to add to that is that rural areas actually, in the United States at least, I think other places too, are the very center of the co-op economy. And in the United States, I work for the National Telephone Cooperative Association, so I was a researcher and employee there, So I got some exposure to that, and it was really an eye-opening experience that the rural economy is run in the United States, and by co-ops. All the different agricultural co-ops, and then all the utility co-ops, and then you have credit unions, and you have a whole sector that serves that those cooperatives. They would not think of themselves as part of the solidarity economy. Okay.
Culturally.
I was surprised to learn that one of the densest aggregations of co-ops in the United States is in Kansas. Right.
Absolutely. We there's like 1,000 telephone co-ops, probably equal number of power like co-op electric utilities. One of the things that Shareable has been working on, starting when I was still running the organization, is getting the cooperative, the electric cooperatives, getting funding from the government so the electro cooperatives can convert to more renewable energy. The co-ops there are the dirtiest in the United States. So there's this huge opportunity. I think that we've been, with it was a, we're just a partner of supporting another organization that's the Rural Power Coalition is really working on this, and we're supporting them. So there is this potential linkage between that established co-op economy in rural areas, and then this potential of putting co-housing or cooperative housing on land where the residents are also stewards of the land, right? Which by the way, I visited this place. It's really promising, and it's totally challenging, man.
I know. I mean, it's all going to be such a challenge. I mean, this whole thing, like we said at the beginning, is so much swimming upstream. But the way I see it, like, we're getting a bifurcation happening now where it's going to be like robot combines or like, cooperative co-op housing with apprenticeships that teaches people how to. And this robot combine is going to be a dust bowl, and these other guys are going to be able to actually grow things and have, a foot of topsoil. So it's fine. It's a marathon, not a sprint, but it's uphill right now. But I do think I just want to say, like, I think there is just such a silly cultural divide. There is so much stewardship. And now that you're telling me this, it's ringing a bell that these rural cooperatives exist. There's so much stewardship with rural, not environmentalist people happening. And there's these cooperatives that's got all this, sort of governance built in, but they just culturally do not link up with like urban environmentalists and urban solidarity economy people. And I just feel like there's so much missed potential there. And Jason and I say this all over and over again, but when you move rural, if you're doing a co-housing thing like this, like, do not become a cultural island from your rural neighbors. You know what I
Right.
mean? Like, the point is, we say this over and over again, but everybody will be better off with some mutual interaction, respect, aid to one another and cultural exchange. But out of mutual respect and not, I guess talking philosophy about degrowth, but instead like, oh, how
Yeah.
did you keep your chickens? How do you do this out here? Sourcing
Absolutely.
materials, all this kind of stuff, and just being a good and respectful neighbor and vice versa with rural people
Yeah.
interacting with urban people.
Yeah, being a good neighbor. I mean, this brings to mind like something that Father Arizmendi, the founder of Mondragon Corporation, one of my favorite quotes from him is, and I'm kind of paraphrasing or shortening maybe, but he said something along the lines that ideas divide, common needs unify. Right? So when we talk about n not our commonality, our common needs. Right, I think this is an important distinction. And when we start talking about those common needs, then and focusing on that, then you can get this kind of bipartisan or this diversity of support for something that is naturally beneficial to anyone, no matter of their ideological, political orientation, their gender, ethnicity, etc. Right?
Yeah. I think, I mean, structurally, what, you know, I think will happen and would be helpful bridging this divide is that urban areas, like the distinction about what people do in rural areas and urban areas has become so stark, right? And so, you know, you mentioned, Ashley, these kind of like, you know, co-apprenticeships or exchange programs, that's helpful. But I also think, you know, there's definitely movements. I'm thinking, for example, like Cooperation Jackson and Cooperation X movement in general that's spreading around, where very much both kind of environmental justice, racial justice, as well as solidarity economy, but it's also urban agrarianism, right? Like they're building, you know, they're building gardens, right? They're, you know, I think the idea is to get land back. Like land is kind of like the central idea, even in urban areas, maybe spreading out to ex-urban areas. And so I see this potential of these movements, you know, urban solidarity economy movements becoming more agrarian, even in the urban areas,
yeah,
especially in the industrialized areas.
Yeah, and that's going to be my little wheelhouse, I think, moving forward for a little while, moving back to Chicago. That was my big thing with my dissertation. I'm curious to report like what I see going on. I remember when I was doing my dissertation research was, you know, about 10 years ago, and it was lots of people like reclaiming empty spaces. I mean, this one place I interviewed, that it was just like it was a former paint factory, industrial wasteland, broken glass and needles and stuff, and they just said like, can we come here and put a bunch of containers in here and mulch some wood chips and turn it into soil and use it? And the local alderman was like, I don't see why not, you know, this
yeah,
would be better than what's going on here. And I would just say, like, with all the talk of getting along with neighbors, yes, of course, but then it's also okay for specific cultures to bloom. Like you were saying, Cooperation Jackson, Jason, I think there's like, you know, like this black urban agrarian movement, like, cool, that's great. You know, you don't have to, these movements can also be diverse and attract a certain type that resonates with it. And that's fine too. You know, it doesn't have to be like one set thing for every city, every type of person, you know?
And the second half of that, I just wanted to bring in real quick, is that rural areas in the United States have been hollowed out, right? That's also an elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone from village economies to, you know, to very just, you know, dilapidated, mostly, you know, some individual families, you know, a trailer park, some, you know, large farm operators, right? But there's not really as much of a society, right? And so the more that I think there's a revival of like bringing back the sociality, the village mentality, the neighborhood mentality into the agrarian areas, coupled with the urban, you know, agrarian kind of, you know, flowering, like that, like culturally, that will build a bridge, you know, ideally that would build a bridge that would, you know, would overcome what is perceived as the stark difference of like, you're a metropolitan person, you're an agrarian person. And like, there's just two different realities right now, but they don't have to be, is what I'm saying. Yeah.
I would also say, just maybe this is more of a mid-level trend, but with the crisis of housing affordability in cities, but in general, you're going to see less of the young generation able to afford to move to these big cities. And I think as suburbs start to be able to maintain themselves less due to the cost of infrastructure or the cost of oil, et cetera, you're going to start seeing, I think, some very interesting experiments in the exurbs, and all these empty malls and all these empty strip malls could be used for some very different purposes. And
totally.
I think, you know, in some ways, you know, the larger cities get a lot of the attention, but in terms of creating, it's not exactly a back to the land moment, but it's, you know, I think you'll be seeing hopefully some suburban retrofitting that will really, create more of a blended mixture here, the way ironically they were intended to be, but you know, never were.
Yeah. We have a couple of guys doing a series on the suburbs on Doomer Optimism, and it's exactly it. Like they were meant to be like little villages outside of the city, that were supposed to be coherent and garden-like and they sort of became this sterile thing, tract housing, and now it's I'm like super excited for this solar punk retro suburbia future. Okay, Jason, how should we wrap up? We got a couple minutes left. Last question.
Yeah, well, I guess my last question is, you know, how can we tie all this together? So if we're trying to build this bridge between the solidarity economy and the bioregionalist, or the solidarity movement, and the bioregionalist movement, there's been a lot of ideas put out there. Do each of you want to, you know, say something that kind of can tie this together into, you know, the take home theme of this recording?
Yeah, I can take what I'll have one idea, like about how might this might take how these two things might tie together or come together, and you know, and now you know, any movement, any change has to be in a reaction to or take into account the larger forces of the meta crisis, the poly crisis, right? And so you know. I want to introduce this idea of intermediary cities. So intermediary cities are cities that are kind of between rural and urban. They're not your global cities, like say in New York or San Francisco, and they are sort of this bridge between rural economies and global knowledge economies, right?
Okay, so for me, I think I just think there's a way to do a more, for me, this is about a more robust civil society and a more robust, like, interaction with the three parts of my dissertation, which is interaction with ecologies, interaction with other people, community, and interaction with work, more meaningful labor. And I just feel like there needs to be a more robust civil society orientation to all three of those things in rural and urban and suburban contexts. With that, and there's so much civil society that needs to be rebuilt. So if you think about ecologies, like if an urban, suburban, or rural person is like really robustly into gardening, there's going to be a cultural connection there. If there's a really robust like connection to meaningful work in the form of taking up some sort of craft work, some sort of knitting skills or sewing or woodworking, there starts to be rebuilt this kind of like culture of making things, of being connected, of meaning, that's more human scaled, that's just less overall about like outsourcing all aspects of our life either to the state or to the market. And then I just think like you know, more urban rural interactions will help a lot. I really have a big question mark in my mind, because like just thinking historically, there's never been a period of time in history where this few people in the developed world have no relationship at all to production, ever in history, this small of a percentage. So I have no idea how those skills come back or don't get lost completely. But like, to me, that is first and foremost the thing that's going to connect the bioregional people and the solidarity economy people, is this like shared necessity to like have a connection with land and production that's not super extractive and that doesn't completely like, you know, destroy the resource base on which we need to live. So that, you know, no big deal, that's just a huge problem to solve, but I just feel like more connection, more learning on this topic, and then I think the reconnection to like a robust civil society is in everything. It's everywhere. It can happen everywhere. It's in all aspects of life. It's being eroded, and like any amount you could do to bring that back is going to be good for both of these movements. Daniel, why don't you go, and then we'll toss it back to Neil.
Sure. Well, I mean, Neil, you were saying before that quote, you know, Ideas divide common needs, unify also common threats, unify. And I think that both the solidarity economy and bioregionalism are threatened in many ways by the same processes. And I think the way that the erosion of our land is going to ultimately jeopardize so many social relations, so many forms of economic production. I mean, that just can't be allowed to happen. And I think that the solidarity economy folks also know that inequality and a lot of the social conditions that they're trying to address, those are ultimately, you know, financialization, all these things, those are tied to the despoiling of land and the abstraction of us from the land around us. And I think being able to ground production and consumption in real places under civil control are a goal of both of these groups. And they don't have to like each other necessarily, but recognize that they're facing the same, that the, in many ways, the same actors are buying up the farm properties and, you know, redlining communities and cities. And I think just, you know, getting away from prescriptions for the moment and getting to what are our needs, what are the obstacles that are preventing us from getting those needs. Having some of those basic questions would be really helpful and just starting some dialogue here, so getting some coalitions for me.
That's great. Yeah. And yeah, just to, you know, continue on my thought, just I see an opportunity with these intermediary cities, which kind of bridge urban and rural, could be part of a kind of managed retreat from coasts, where you have these big coastal cities that are going to need to, you know, either depopulate or spend a tremendous amount of money to be protected. Might not be economically viable, and that kind of spatial and geographic like transition could be combined with an economic and ecological transition, and that could be intermediary cities could be a focal point.
Love it.
Yeah.
Jason, you're
up. Just wrap is kind of a summary. You want to live in a village, learn village skills. I think, you know, we can't really control the deeper structural conditions that will, you know, will change us swimming upstream to having the wind at our backs. I do think those structural conditions, you know, are coming to a head. In the meantime, I think that, you know, in the long term, part of this is a distributist vision to me of like broader, you know, distribution of the means of production and the skills of production, right?
Yeah.
And the coordination of production, you know, at the human scale, i.e. cooperatives, et cetera. And so, you know, I think what you were talking about, Ashley, of, you know, okay, I hear this conversation, it's idealistic, but where do I start? Start by learning practical skills. You know, we hammer this home over and over again. Learn how to garden, learn how to knit, learn how to bake, learn how to do woodworking, learn how to do pottery, whatever it is, right? Learn how to intermediate with other people, how to be a bridge, a peacemaker, a bridge builder between different types of people, right? There's many different, so the relational skills. You know, the broader that we can build these skills when the structural conditions change for, you know, a common concern in both bioregionalist and solidarity economy is the broad distribution of the means of production, right? Whether it's land or whether it's housing, you know, whatever it happens to be. You know, we don't have the wind at our backs right now. We're swimming upstream, but we can, you know, learn the village skills. And I think that'll serve us well, you know, either in structural changes biophysically or political, you know, and maybe in combination with political movements that, you know, find their opening under changing biophysical conditions. We'll be ready.
Yep, that's beautifully said. All right, well, I just want to thank Neil and Daniel for coming on. This is a really great conversation. I would say I'm already calling it an instant classic. it's a great culmination of a lot of the thinking we've done over the course of the podcast, and so this has been lovely. Thank you both so much for coming on, and it was a pleasure to be with you again, Jason.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed this, guys. Seriously, this was fun, and we went deep, and to an extent, but I think we just kind of scratched the surface too.
Yeah, totally. If we need to, we're gonna have to turn this into a series or something if we keep wanting to go deeper. We'll put your ways to connect with you guys in the show notes. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Bye bye.
Cheers.